From out of the city.
My guest this week, the mountain poet, Daniel S. McTaggart. To anybody who spends much time hanging around my work, you run across the name of Daniel S. McTaggart, or as I often refer to him, Tag. Dan is a poet out of Morgantown, West Virginia, which is actually my old stomping ground, who has the amazing ability to reconnect with the blue-collar sensibilities, the man-on-the-street sensibilities, that we haven't seen a lot of in the poetry of our modern generation. So involved are we in the technological splendor and the artistic supremacy of this time that we've kind of lost the Kerouac and the Hall and the touch of reality that brings us in. So I wanted to get Dan in here into the studio to read some of his works, and so we can talk about them, and you can get a taste of his work. His first book is coming out this spring, and it's tentatively titled
Midnight Muse in a Convenience Store.
Coming this spring from Daniel S. McTaggart. And so, Dan, you don't mind if I call you Dan, do you?
Not at all.
How about Danny?
That works.
Danny boy?
Go for it.
Okay. Anyway, Dan, you know, I've read your manuscript. I've read your works before. And I'm always impressed by the way you kind of pancake your metaphor with the reality. I was talking about one piece of yours, Song of a Spoon.
Mm-hmm.
Is that the right title?
Yes.
And what I'd like you to do in just a moment is read it for us. But the beauty of that is there. It's almost like, I was telling you, almost like in the movie Matrix, where you'll see something happening in this alternate reality, and then there'll be a moment where there's an unreality as the reality is adjusting to it, and then the reality kicks back in, like when the helicopter flies into the side of the building. And there's a bit where you're describing a spoon being dropped, that the metaphor kind of slides through. And we're talking about an everyday event in poetic terms. And it really reinforces the sense. And I want to know, in your work, is this just something that's kind of a natural fit for you? And or is it just something that you had to work into in order to build this this niche for yourself among poets?
In most of my work, metaphors like that just come out naturally. I'm not even aware they're metaphors a lot of the time. It's more of an instinct, I guess you could say. And the poem you refer to is almost like an instinctive poem. You know how birds sing? One sings on this side of the neighborhood, another one sings on the other side of the neighborhood in answer. You know, in the poem I'm going to read, I hear the sound of a spoon clanking against a coffee cup, and some instinct rises up within me, and I have to answer in return.
Fair enough. So why don't you go ahead and honor us with that poem right now, and after you're through with that, you know, I'd like to move on to some other areas, but I really think that people would enjoy that one right now. So, without further ado, this is Dan McTaggart doing Song of a Spoon.
Song of a Spoon. I walked into the diner seeking refuge from the territorial chatter of birds. I sat down hoping to indulge in a quiet cup of coffee and a steaming plate of steak and eggs. From the other end, I could discern the song of a spoon stirring and landing on a saucer. A primal urge moved me to add a dash of cream and use my spoon to craft my own melody. My eyes were so fixed on crossword clues that I mistakenly set the spoon beyond the table's edge. My spoon fell through space, clanging in a silver sing-song rhythm. Then a plate shattered on the kitchen floor, and I stared stiffly through the swinging door. Everyone froze, their eyes locked in that direction. And I asked for a new spoon.
Okay, Dan, I'm going to throw a little curveball in here. You and I have a commonality in our early inspirations as writers, and that is comic books. You and I have both been avid readers of comic books, and you know, I grew up in the era when Stan Lee, the genius behind the real golden age of Marvel, took it upon himself to raise the level of education required to even understand a comic book. He basically said he wanted to put it at a college-level vocabulary. So a lot of my early vocabulary development came from comic books, as well as a lot of my knowledge of Norse mythology coming from the mighty Thor. How did comic books and that whole fantastic genre, whether we're talking Stan Lee or Roy Thomas or Frank Miller, affect your development as a writer and how you look at the world?
Well, like you said, it was a big boost to my vocabulary as well. It helped me to refer to my own memories in a sequence of events, almost like a panel-by-panel sequence. So it'd be easier for me to sort out my own memories, my own feelings, especially as I write them down. This mood is in that panel, and this mood is in that panel. And there's a point in all poems where you pause, like turning a page.
The poet as a verbal Neil Adams, more or less.
Yeah.
For those comic book freaks out there, you understand exactly what we're saying. So this book you're putting out this spring, Midnight Muse in a Convenience Store?
Yes.
Okay. Tell us a little something about that, what it's about, where it's coming from, the title, the genesis of the project, more or less. And, just let the people know, because, people are going to be wandering around this spring with money in their pockets, wanting to spend it on something. And, after they buy all the really cool, 360 games, they're going to have some money left over to buy books. And, we certainly want you to be on their list.
Definitely.
So tell us a little bit about the project.
Well, the title is Midnight Muse in a Convenience Store. I think that's pretty much the working title for now. It's a collection of poems that I wrote mostly during the midnight shift when I worked at the gas station.
That's right. You've worked real-world jobs. You're not like an academic who says, well, I went to college, and now I'm going to learn how to write poetry, and now I'm going to write poetry.
Yeah. This was a gas station / convenience store / liquor store, and there is no limit to the variety of characters that would come in through those doors at night. I just couldn't help but pen some of them down. And so you'll find a lot of interesting characters in this book. There's also a lot of poems about the images and the feelings of night. Not just the people who move through it, but the way night moves around you and through you. I have scenes that take place outside the store, in the sky, or just off in a never-never-never-never-land realm. They even get a little metaphysical sometimes, which is...
Oh, I'm sorry, you're not allowed to do metaphysical.
Yeah.
We passed that law, I get the metaphysical and the romantic, you get the real world.
Yeah, well, fortunately for you, that's a boundary I don't cross very often.
Fortunately for me.
Okay. Yeah.
You did bring us one of the poems that's going to be in this book. Mm-hmm. What's the name of the piece?
A Tale from Behind the Register.
Okay, why don't you give the audience a taste of that now, and then we'll get on to some other questions, and then I'll let you go wild with a few more pieces, all right?
All righty.
This is Dan McTaggart doing Tale from Behind the Register?
Yes.
From his forthcoming book, Midnight Muse in the Convenience Store.
A Tale from Behind the Register. Weathery nights pass into silent mornings. A limping old man strolls in for coffee. Smiling, he waves and greets his fellow liars. Together they sip and blather about hunting and retirement. Laughing, they snipe each other over bad hair and no hair. Coffee wanes, and the old men leave to tell the same lies somewhere else. Disheveled women shuffle through the door, counting food stamps, buying bulk on paper towels. Their blank stares speak of the bruises surrounding their faces. Gathering bags, they walk wordlessly outside with skeletal grace, sometimes pausing in mid-stride, staring behind themselves to make contact with anyone, then turn and go unnoticed. Sunlight cycles down to dusk. Cars pass by, immaterial in the dark. Just two tandem lights racing like young lovers.
Another thing that we've discussed before, Dan, is the cathartic reality of poetry. You and I are both big believers in poetry as a cathartic tool, not just in terms of literary creation, but in the way for the individual artist to get out of dark places and corners that they find themselves boxed into emotionally. I mean, I know that, you know, I, for one, have used my poetry to escape the depression associated with failed relationships or the disintegrating relationship I had with my daughter, whereas you have used yours to get out of depressive areas and even, you know, while in recovery from health issues. So I know that that has some interplay to the poems of this book. So would you like to, you know, run with that for a minute while I take a drink of soda? So people know I'm not putting words in your mouth.
Yeah. Well, I started first writing these poems back in 1999. These were the first poems I had written in about 4 years. I had just gone through a severe depression back around 95 or 96. When I got out, I found I just could not write anything. I think of it as losing my gift.
Which can be like devastating for a writer.
Yeah, like a piano player would lose some fingers, a dancer would lose some toes.
Brad Pitt should fall down a mountain on his face, you know, anything like
yeah.
that.
Yeah. And I just got a rather nasty example in my head that I could use, but I'm not going to. So this.
It's not about me, so.
Oh, definitely not. So this book is a huge healing catharsis for me, because it's basically the return of something I thought I lost, and it's almost like a sunrise. The sun doesn't come all the way up, but you see the first beams of light breaking over the horizon, and every poem that came after that, is like the sun getting a little higher. And I've also ebbed where I've had times I still didn't write too much after that, but I could still feel the gift wasn't completely gone. It rise and flowed like the tides, sort of.
Okay. Well, I think you expressed that very well. Gee whiz, maybe you should be a writer.
What?
Along those lines, I noticed you brought a few other pieces, and why don't you go ahead and do those for us now? And then we're going to have to get to my segment, wrap up, and you know, shut this thing down before the internet police come and beat us up and tell us we can't talk anymore.
I'll tell them you did it.
Thanks.
From one seat in the diner. The whole world can happen at speeds too comfortable to count. A group of travelers may barge inside, carrying a woman, weak from the weight of the sun, choked by swallowed dust thrown up from the road. They may demand for her a glass of ice water, and the worker may pause out of nervousness and ask if she wants ice with it. For God's sake, yes, they'll scream. And so he'll scramble for ice, and finding there is none, throw in a handful of shavings. And when he hands it over, they'll ask, where the hell's the ice? We don't have any, he'll say. You don't have any? Their eyes may boil, and they may want to throw that water in his face. But they may instead give it to her as they hear her moan, and from one seat in the diner they'll stare at him accusingly, as if to say, how dare he promise ice and not deliver? And they may blame him for the slowness of her recovery, if they didn't already blame themselves. Rock Frenzy. In Pennsylvania fields, rocks stick up like shark fins, swimming slowly through soil, searching for the freshest hint of blood. Though there hasn't been a frenzy here for generations, these predators are patient, preferring not to send ripples through the grassy calm, waiting instead for storms to send their claws down on unsuspecting prey, and then at last, they may feed. Disadvantages of a setting sun. The light that people swim through does not ripple as much when the sun is not there to dance with waves we make as we walk, and the features of a woman lose depth when drowned in shadow. It is harder to let go of a hand when there may not be enough light left to reach for it again. One cannot watch leaves applaud the winds as they tumble through branches like a circus act. One cannot always wait for stars to fall off their tightrope and bathe in the collective gasp of an awestruck night sky. Only the moon may enjoy thrills and feats beyond the scope of human eyes, taunting us with what we may never hope to see. Pottery boots. A pair of muddy boots stands next to a heating vent, slowly caking flecks and swatches of mud into a hard shell, polished by fingers of dust flagellating from the vent's ridges, so that an avant-garde work of art now stands in the corner instead of just another pair of muddy boots. Gun heavy. The girl's purse landed on the counter with a loud thump. The cashier was startled by the tremor, which he could feel through his feet. "That's a heavy purse," he said. "Oh, that," she smiled. "My girlfriend calls it gun heavy because it's so heavy I must be carrying a gun in there." The cashier nodded blankly. "That'll be $6.15. The girl cheerily walked out of the store, the straps digging into her shoulder as the purse swung like a slow pendulum, smashing into her hip with every other step.
Well, I guess it's time for me to put up or shut up. And for this week's reading, I've chosen from my book, Love Gods of a Forgotten Religion, the poem, The Garden of Souls. This poem is about the 1997 Southern Poets Reading Tour, which was hosted by Claiborne Schley Walsh out of Mobile, Alabama. On that trip, my soon-to-be second wife, Anne, came along to aid me with my book sales, and it was for that very tour that I consented and assented to the publication of my first book, Pantheon. And this poem is about the characters that I met on that trip. Some of them became very, very dear to me, and all of them were so remarkably talented. So here we go, The Garden of Souls. Sacred cinnabar, placed against the fire to bleed living silver into the river baths of the alchemists. Red to liquid gray, playful imp of elemental conjuration unbound, found sinew in stone. And so it goes in the Garden of Souls. Cautious lovers, fooling no one, but feeding the hopeful romantics with their basket of loaves and fishes of a sacrament in silence. Dreamers finding new formulae to weave their night tapestries in earnest awakenings, unregarded as they hoard tomorrow. Children finding mother and father, barren wombs birthing life in a patina haze of morning mists kissed with the placental scent. Communion blood cups of blueberry wine and red wards painted by a kiss to signify nothing that can be explained in simple words. And through it all, a trip to Sinai, a transfiguration of the unseen, a unity unwound like bandages of a royal relic, mummified in cloves and myrrh and oils of trees that no longer grow on desert soil, toiling only to understand, for the sounds come freely and in great truth. My sisters, my brothers, my children, my lovers, and all the winds that stir the locks of hair misplaced like spineless horns of golden fire. I have seen the evocation. I have seen the summoning. I have seen life held in 20 hands to offer drinks of regent tears to those who thirst.
Well, I want to thank Dan McTaggart again for dropping by from out of the city. And I want to... I want to full panel splash effect, you know. Gil Kane can come in here and pencil the kapow. And, you know, I'd encourage you this spring when his book, Midnight Muse in a Convenience Store, comes out to certainly check it out. I think it'd be well worth adding to your library. Dan's an extraordinarily gifted writer whose blue-collar sensibilities, real-world sensibilities, I find refreshing because I can never seem to get to that side of the fence, and thank God he stays out of my side, because I don't like the competition.
That was nice.
Yeah.
Too bad I don't have a 20 on me.
You can owe it to me. So anyway, anything you want to say before you get out of here, Dan?
I'd just like to say I hope people enjoy what I've read, and I hope you look out for my book, I think they're going to enjoy it.
It's been an honor.
Thank you for joining us for our Christmas episode of From Out of the City. Please join us next week when our guest will be... Well, that's my secret. But I promise a most unique New Year's celebration. Take care. God bless. This is William F. DeVault, the romantic poet of the internet.